Welcome, welcome, welcome to a new episode of Digging a Hole, the Legal Theory Podcast. On this podcast, my co-host Sam Moyne and I, David Schleicher, talk about legal theory. And this is the last episode of our first season. So, Sam, what do you think? How has your life changed now that you've become a media host?
You know, David, in the immortal words of Rex Reed, I laughed, I cried. This has been a season of highs and lows. No, seriously, it has been, you know, enthralling. And, you know, I've moved from books to, you know, magazine pieces to, you know, podcasts, and it's head spinning, but always fun.
Next thing you know, you're going to be doing TikTok.
I know, like my daughters, but they've tried to get me on and I just can't break the barrier. But, you know, you can teach an old dog new tricks. I'm really excited about season two. And I just want to tell all of our millions of listeners that we're very open if you just send David or me an email to considering, you know, who we ought to invite on next season, which means spring.
Terrific, terrific. And today's episode, the last of the season, is going to be great. We have on the show with us Omar Wasow from Princeton University, who wrote an article about the way protest movements in the 1960s affected elections in the 1960s that became a major news story on its own in over the course of this last summer. And so we're really excited to talk to him. Let's get into it. So we're super excited to have on the podcast today Omar Wasow. So rarely does a piece of empirical social science kind of break through not just the news, but into the day-to-day warp and woof of politics the way that Professor Wasow's paper, Agenda Seeding, How 1960s Black Protests Moved Elites, Public Opinion, and Voting, did this spring and summer. And so we're really excited to get a chance to talk about it, not just during this moment when it was so in the news and so exciting, but kind of looking back both at its kind of predictions or the kind of implications for both the protest movement over the summer and the elections. So we're wondering, maybe before we get started with questions, whether you could just kind of tell us a little bit about the paper. Like, what does it find? What's going on? So anyway, thanks so much for coming.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. And please feel free to call me Omar. So let me give a little bit of background on the paper, just kind of how I came to it and then get into the results. So I grew up in New York in the 1980s and came of age in a moment where, like, kind of law and order politics dominated the
me too.
Era. Oh, okay. So then, yeah. I don't want to go too into the weeds, but it's like, what high school did you go to? So you know, this was a moment where kind of tough on crime was really the order of the day, and my parents had come of age as young people active in the civil rights movement, and it's sort of this, like, that was for me this kind of high point in American history, and I was trying to figure out how did we get from there. Coming of age and the kind of the successes of the civil rights era to my coming of age in this very repressive, tough on crime era. And so after being an entrepreneur for a dozen years, went back to grad school and really tried to dig into this question. And in particular, was struck by a pattern that if you look at incarceration between roughly 1900 and now, it's reasonably flat for decades. I mean, it goes up some decades, it goes down some decades, but it's surprisingly stable through about the early 1970s, and then it just hockey sticks up, right? And so that suggested a puzzle, which is, what is it that happened in the late 1960s, early 70s that contributed to this, like, inflection point in our policing and kind of, you know, kind of criminal justice policy? And that took me to looking in a way that I hadn't kind of set out to initially, really trying to understand what in the period of civil rights change was potentially contributing to this rising taste for repressive politics. And there certainly other people had engaged with this. But one of the things that really stood out was the transition between the early 1960s and late 1960s between protests where activists were primarily relying on civil disobedience, in which the tactics were largely nonviolent, to a later era where there were a lot more violent protests, where there's a lot of police violence, but there's also a lot of protester violence. And so the kind of resistance to segregation and white supremacy was much more aggressive. And trying to figure out to what degree did those different kinds of tactics influence public policy, and to what degree does violence as a method advance a cause or potentially, depending on the context, retard the movement.
So it's great that you're with us, and both David and I, were found the whole thing last summer gripping on Twitter and bleeding outside. I'm a historian, and I'm forced to be the kind of resident skeptic about empirical social science just because David is a giddy enthusiast. You've wandered into this, and I'm not able to meet you on your own ground the way David is, but my general concern about this sort of work coming from history is that we find an attempt first to kind of get at some law-like regularities that will presumably obtain in pretty different situations, and you want this to be action guiding. And of course, this summer we had a lot of attempts to kind of generate some lessons from the past that would map on to the present. And then second, there's often like a kind of, sense that this is kind of science going on, but clearly, those doing the investigation are, political beings themselves. And you've just begun by talking about your background and like how you came to this topic and such. So I guess with all that background, I'm not gonna kind of challenge what you've done, because it seems like so ironclad on its own ground. But I wanted to ask you, do you feel vindicated or not by the 2020 elections? Like, do you see kind of the aftermath of this summer as kind of showing that you were right in suggesting that these are portable lessons, maybe for our present? Or even if it doesn't explain what happened with Donald Trump, but maybe the weakening of the Democrats, at least in some districts, or does it turn out that the truths we learn from the late 60s in particular don't turn out to be universal, because reality is messy and political intuitions don't turn out to travel in new situations?
Those are great questions, and they're both things I've been thinking about a lot. And so let me maybe summarize the findings from the paper just in case people haven't engaged with it, and then come to like, does it travel, right? So so broadly what I find is that in the 1960s, the Black freedom struggle was particularly effective in an earlier period. I think our kind of conventional story is there was nonviolent resistance. And while that was effective, what really worked was nonviolent resistance met by really kind of brutal state repression, because that solved a problem, which is that a peaceful protest was often seen as boring by the mainstream white press. There's a famous line in that I quote, where the New York Times reporter at a big protest in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, says, an unprecedented picket line is a dull story. Blood and guts are news, right? And so that was a challenge for the civil rights movement. How do we draw attention from the non-segregation part of America, that is to say the non-segregated South, draw in the media when they have only a limited attention span for nonviolent protests? And so the strategy increasingly became putting civil disobedience, putting activists in the line of fire of folks like Bull Connor, who would, shoot fire hoses at children. And those images powerfully, both nationally and internationally, reshaped the kind of public taste, the public support for the segregationist order, right? So that violence was used in a very strategic way to make activists the target of state violence, and then to channel that through the media to change public opinion in favor of civil rights legislation. In the later period of the 1960s, what I find is that there's, again, this more aggressive resistance to police violence, to segregation. And in those periods where there are violent protests, the media coverage tends to focus much less on civil rights, as in the earlier period, but on crime, riots, disorder, and that moves public opinion and legislation much more towards this tough on crime law and order era. And in particular, coming now to the kind of heart of your question, I find that it's likely that the wave of violent protests following King's assassination were, moved enough counties from the Republican coalition into the Democratic coalition, from the from the egalitarian coalition into the Law and Order coalition, Democrats to Republicans, that it likely tipped the 1968 election towards Nixon and allowed Nixon running on Law and Order to win. Right. So then fast forward to now, you know, what is the same and what's different, right? And I think there's some core things that are similar. And I should add, I'm deeply sympathetic to your skepticism. You know, I mean, I've tried to like watch the last year with an open mind so that I, you know, I'm both testing my theory, but I want to see, does it travel? And I think there are a couple of things that seem to be pretty deeply human that do travel, right? So one is violence against people is something that people, that audiences have strong norms about, and they recoil against a sense that somebody's being a bully or an aggressor, right? So when the police are engaging in excess violence, the heart of this whole movement is the kind of the brutality of officer, I'm now forgetting his name, the gentleman, the officer who rests his knee on George Floyd's neck, the violence of that, right? The kind of stark asymmetry in state power and subjugated citizen is the spark, right? And so that kind of as a consistent pattern in human nature, I think, remains true. And similarly, there was a non-trivial amount of media coverage of. Like there was a Washington Post headline that was roughly in protests against police violence, police engage in excess violence, right? And so it's like that there was a way in which we saw a similar pattern of when the police over-responded, when they engaged in what were sometimes called police riots, that became the story. And that kind of echoes a larger concern about racial injustice in America. At the same time, I think when protesters engaged in violence, we saw two things. One that I think is consistent with the past and now I think maybe some things where I have to kind of update. So one is violence in the 1960s and now draws in the media, right? So when Minneapolis fire police station goes up in flames, like the entire country, in fact, you know, even larger international audiences are paying attention. And so violence is a very powerful way to get the media's attention. And particularly in right of center media, we saw a heavy focus on a kind of crime story, a Blue Lives Matter story, right? And so that's kind of consistent with the 1960s too. But I think in our more fragmented media now, and given that roughly 93% of the protests were peaceful, you saw a kind of a fragmentation where there were very different stories depending on what media you were consuming. And that, I think, is probably somewhat different, not totally, from the 1960s. And so there are ways in which violence helped the movement, drawing in attention, hurt the movement in terms of helping to polarize the issue in partisan lines, particularly as it played out in media. And given that the protests were overwhelmingly peaceful, it also sort of looks a little bit more, as I wrote in one piece, like 1964 than 1968, an era where there was a kind of mass sympathy for civil rights as opposed to opposition.
Yeah, so that's exactly where I wanted to go next, which is that so much of your paper, it's like framed as being about protest tactics and agenda setting, but so much of the operating guts is about the structure of media and how they respond. And you kind of treat it as a neutral, like blood and guts is what plays. But there's this huge literature on the way in which, say, declines in local newspapers have affected elections. And this is, I think, kind of actually have a piece with a lot of this, the decline in when local newspapers close, split ticket voting goes away, that you know, borrowing costs for local government go up because there's no one watching local corruption. What I'm wondering is like how much of your model is premised on the particular form of media that we saw in the 1960s. So you're using national media sources, but the reason that you'd see a localized effect would be because of local media. And in the 1960s, we had very powerful local newspapers who were formally nonpartisan, but had a kind of particular ideology about fact gathering, what's newsy, what's plays, that's different than it was in, the yellow journalism period, and is different than it is today. So I wonder how much of your story, how much the tactical moves make sense or intelligible in different media universes. And so you could think about the social media universe we're in today, but also in something where like Britain, where the media is national and partisan. for the most part. The newspapers are largely national and largely ideological. I don't know if you call them partisan, but ideological. So how much of your result in the 1960s do you think was driven by the media universe that exists today as much as it was driven by the tactical strategies or their interaction?
It's a great question. It's a great question. I think there's something really deeply human about how we make sense of stories. And those stories have a good guy and a bad guy, and they can't be too complicated, and they often can be distilled to an image or a short video clip. And like, that's how our brains make sense of the world. And sort of things like partisanship and ideology, you know, are often, can you know, will play an active role in which of those images we're exposed to and may affect how we interpret those images. But those images do a lot of work. And I think that's very clearly what activists in the 1960s figured out, right? The media were an important ally in getting their story out, as you noted. It's also important to note, though, that in the 1960s, in the South, the media, the newspapers were overwhelmingly pro-segregation, right? So there was a bifurcated media where there were essentially three, I mean, maybe trifurcated, right? There's a Black press that's covering Black interests. There's a pro-segregation press that's hostile to Black interests. And then there's an outside of the South press that's largely indifferent to Black interests. And it's not aligned with segregation, but it's not particularly concerned with the the degree to which there's this profound inequality in the South. And so in some ways, the whole strategy is to create, I mean, to use the language of John Lewis and others, if you can kind of create spectacles of violence, if you can dramatize injustice, then you can draw in these outside audiences. It's essentially change the kind of theater of contestation, right? It's no longer just a debate between Southern segregationists and Black freedom fighters. It becomes a national debate. And that's one that African-Americans could win potentially. And so in that context, I think there is some fragmentation and it's also important to realize that television is a brand new medium in that moment, right? So like TV news, if you look at a book, Pulitzer Prize winning book, the Race Beat, like part of the story that comes through is that, to use a weird kind of modern term, like television doesn't know what it's doing in news. And so civil rights becomes the killer app of TV news. Like literally the justification for TV news is coverage of civil rights. And so there are ways in which it's actually kind of oddly similar. There's this new medium. It's transforming how we make sense of these events. And now I think the analog, I mean, the modern analogy is with cell phone cameras, like suddenly you don't need ABC there to document the, you know, lynching of Ahmaud Arbery, right? Suddenly that's just somebody shooting it with their phone. And as that goes out, it becomes part of the national conversation. And so I think there are some really important echoes. There are these short kinds of clips that have good guys and bad guys that where people, it's a morality tale and people are moved emotionally more than they are by any kind of particular set of partisan facts. And that does a lot of work then and now. And in some ways, the kind of bearing witness that was done then is becoming even more common now as more people have access to those tools of documenting and dramatizing those injustices.
Yeah, so that's exactly where I wanted to go next. So one thing our listeners may not know is that in addition to being a very successful academic, you founded a social media company. And so I wanted to know about the role social media plays here. And so one thing is that the democratization of media gives more tools to protesters, and that you mentioned they can document, but also they have a greater ability to shape the narrative one way or the other because they are controlling the means of the media on some level. They are the media on some level. We all are the media on some level. On the other hand, it also gives it reduces their ability to play on the, or anyone's ability to play on the power or preferences of gatekeepers, right? So if the New York Times will print something if there's blood, well, Newsmax getting clips from wherever will play on whatever, something that doesn't require that, doesn't require actual. And so one of the things that strikes me about your whole story here is that the reality of it matters less and less on some level, which is that whether it was actually violent is neither here nor there, ?
Yeah, so I think there are two or three important points there, right? There's a study I was just looking at which finds, for example, when the minority activists, Black in the US, they also look at Palestinian and Ethiopian activists in Israel, it is an experimental design, but people are presented with a news report where either there are Black or white activists as part of a Black Lives Matter movement in the US, or Israeli or Palestinian or Ethiopian activists engaged in activism in Israel. And what they find is that the majority group, that is to say, whites in the U.S. or Israelis in Israel, are, you know, more sympathetic to the same activism when it's done by the majority group than by the minority group, right? So there's sort of, so there's one level of difference, which is that when you are that statistical minority engaging in activism, there's stereotypes about this group being violent, there's stereotypes about this group being more disruptive that influence how people are, how the majority is interpreting those events. And on top of that, you are exactly right that the media have a lot of discretion, and depending on the degree to which those media are really trying to document what's happening on the ground or not, you can have what happened in some cases with Fox, where they were showing footage that was a week or two old as part of a kind of story about violence. I went on several, I did a broad range of media as part of the kind of interest in this. And I did a couple of radio programs that were right of center talk radio shows. And I was really struck by the degree to which there was just this kind of, you know, the hosts were asking me again and again about, well, what about crime? And I, you know, as somebody who grew up in New York in the 80s, in a moment where there were something like 2,500 homicides in New York in a year, and now it's down to, you know, 400, 500, 300, you know, it's like, I was like, you know, we're in a dramatically safer era than in my lifetime, but you're exactly right. It's sort of uncoupled from what's happening on the ground, right? A few high profile incidents can be looped on TV or can become a kind of narrative, if that's a useful narrative. That is clearly something that was true in the 1960s, though, as well. I mean, King talks about the degree to which violence as a method, you know, while he understands the rage and, like, he, you know, as he famously says, right, it's a you know, it's a way for the unheard to be heard, right? It's also, he says, it gives white people, lets them off the hook. Right, it allows them to not feel guilty about the larger injustice. And I think that's some of what we see is a kind of shift in focus to let, if there's this claim being made for equality, and that's a difficult claim to sit with, it's much easier to kind of focus on the degree to which there, you know, at the 7% of events, there was crime. The other thing I would say, just as a final quick point on your point about, like, what happens on the ground may not matter that much, is, you know, these are contentious events. And so you can have 1,000 people protesting peacefully and one car gets lit on fire, and that's going to be visually much more compelling. So that might be what gets on the TV news. And it is true that a car was on fire, but it's not representative, right? So that's always going to be a challenge both for the media and for activists. But it is in that context, right? I mean, I am assuming in the model that there is going to be this bias in the media against statistical minorities, against, you know, a boring event, in favor of violence. And so given that reality, like, what kinds of tactics are likely to be most effective? And that's I think in some ways that's different now, but still kind of an underlying truth about how media will cover contentious politics.
So you treat violence and nonviolence as a kind of, you know, tactical dichotomy, and, you know, it allows you to kind of get a thrilling result. Of course, at the same time, you know, in this era and before and since, there's a whole kind of ethical debate about, you know, what does it mean to be nonviolent? Why should we adopt that approach mobilizationally? And, you know, the interesting thing, at least as far as I'm concerned, for someone like King, at least most of the time, and especially for his predecessors, you know, in this tradition, like Mohandas Gandhi or Leo Tolstoy, you know, they're not consequentialists. Their argument for nonviolence is not that it will make the world better compared to some alternative tactic. And you might argue that the reverse is true for advocates of violence, that they say, look, you know, the system's violent, we're not introducing violence. And they have some argument that is similarly not consequentialist. And so I'm wondering, you know, if you could show this paper counterfactually to Malcolm X, whether he would care, or whether those, you know, in 1968, organizing those protests that are bringing about, you know, the formation of a silent majority and you know, Hubert Humphrey's loss would care. Now, I assume they would and should, but and it's not like your paper is, it, you know, fails just because there are other ethical arguments out there than consequentialist ones, like do the tactics make the world better or worse in the short term? But I'm just wondering, you know, how do you think about this as an intervention, which it in effect it is, in a kind of long debate, which is broadly ethical and political, not just social scientific, about the uses of violence?
Yeah, that's you know, my thinking on this changed over the course of the paper, and so over the course of revisions, one of the things I tried to really do is to say, I violence clearly can be an ethical response, right? So people we hold up as icons of ethical leadership, someone like Nelson Mandela, was sent to prison, engage in armed resistance against apartheid, right? And I have no quarrel with that battle, right? Jewish resistance to Nazi the rise of the Nazis, right? Like, I have no quarrel with violent resistance to the Nazis. And so so it's not that violence is in and of itself immoral in kind of a, just, you know, leaving the 60s aside. And I think the kinds of claims that someone like Malcolm X makes, where it says, you know, I don't self-defense, I don't call it self-defense, right? I call it intelligence, right? To fight back, fight for your life is generally considered a moral and ethical, state if you're being attacked, right? So in some ways, you're getting at something that I almost try to concede and take off the table in the paper, right? It's like I'm not arguing for the morality or immorality of violence. I'm trying to say, like, given a range of possible options where you're operating, and to be clear, not just in, you know, 1960s Black America, but all over the world, subordinate group activists are trying to figure out how do we advance our agenda against, you know, almost overwhelming odds. And given that kind of stacked deck, what kinds of things are effective? And let us not take violence off the table. Let's treat violence as a legitimate method and kind of see how that plays out, right? Now, important differences between apartheid South Africa and kind of Nazi the Jewish resistance to Nazis is there's enough of an active press, going back to the earlier point, that becomes a way for you can engage in asymmetric politics. You can engage in asymmetric tactics where a small group, African Americans are 10% of the population in the 1960s. They can build a governing majority by, you know, revealing the profound inequality, the profound injustice of Jim Crow segregation through the media, right? And so that's one possible tactic, and violence is another, and they're not mutually exclusive. I mean, we saw in some cases groups like the Black Panthers engaged in food programs at schools for kids, and also, you know, took arms to the California State House as a way of protesting and for gun rights, it's sort of in that milieu. I'm trying to say, like, okay, well, let's like test these theories and take Stokely Carmichael or Bayard Rustin's ideas seriously, and then see how do they play out. So just to kind of come at the last, one of the other interesting details of this is, right, Malcolm X and others sort of famously said, by any means necessary. And that's always interpreted as an argument for violence, right? But of course, by any means necessary is a deeply consequentialist argument, right? It's like, whatever's going to get us to the promised land, that's what we should do. And so my hypothetical debate with Malcolm X would be, well, if you're genuinely committed to by any means necessary, then that should include a repertoire of resistance tactics that might not include violence, that might be effective, that might advance the cause without generating this counter-mobilization. And if that's the case, then by any means necessary should speak very much to the power of the kinds of tactics that seem to work, particularly civil disobedience met by a violent state.
I just want to get absolutely clear, because this is just fascinating. Because the beginning of your answer sort of sounded like you were saying, I'm just giving you this kind of relatively narrow finding, and then, you know, you have the panoply of like ethical thinking, and you may want to own the consequences in light of other frameworks do your best. But the end of your answer seemed like it was somewhat different. It was saying, look, the Jews and, you know, Nelson Mandela under apartheid were in a different situation where they might not have had the same nonviolent option. And we should be consequentialists if we have that option where we can anticipate enough similarity between situations that the late 60s should lead us to opt for that politics because the results make the world worse. And that's the right standard.
Yeah. So I think the standard, another really, I appreciate your keying in on that kind of subtlety. So I think for me, the standard is I'm trying to put myself in the eyes of Black activists in the 1960s. And I'm trying to sort of look at the world through their eyes and then slightly more generally look through the eyes of the world of some, subordinate group activist and try to understand, given the kind of constraints they're under, again, biased media, systematic discrimination, repression by the state, what are the range of options before them? What are the theories they're kind of theories of change they're engaging with, and how do those play out, right? And in that consideration, so I think of it as a kind of constrained power, right? I think there's often a debate in both in Black politics, but more generally about, you know, structure versus agency. And I think what's unhelpful about that is clearly structure matters. People operate within enormous constraints. And at the same time, even under enormous constraints, we see people at the very bottom of society engage in acts of resistance to power. So whether that's hunger strikes in prison or slow walking on a factory floor, right? People with very little power are able to assert agency. And so the way I try to kind of braid those together, and this isn't front and center in the paper, it's more like this is coming into the book project, is to think about people operating with constrained power, right? So they do have some agency. There is some, to use a kind of psych term, like a locus of control. And so let's think about within that locus of control, what can they do, and how does that play out, right? So among the things we should think about as constraints are, is this a state willing to engage in extra legal killing, right? So it's like I just saw that the murder of Fred Hampton, a Black Panther, something like 51 years ago, a day or two ago. And that's, Black Panther shot in his sleep, right? I mean, it's just an extrajudicial killing, right? And so given a state that's willing to do that, how does that change our kind of the calculus of this? Similarly, given a media that operates somewhat independent of the state, how does that change our calculus, right? And as we take those things in, we can begin to say, oh, okay, if you're under a dictatorship where there's not a free media and you've got, a threat of extrajudicial killing, that might suggest one set of options. But if you do have the free press that could be a potential ally, that suggests a different set of options. And I think part of what I might, if I were in conversation with Stokely Carmichael or, later in his life, Kwame Ture, I might sort of, like, they were taking inspiration from the anti-colonial independence movements around the world. And I think part of what that may have missed is the degree to which an active free press in the United States is a different context than one in which there's not an active free press.
So I want to key in exactly kind of where you left off on what is the source of this power. And so you start you title the paper Agenda Seeding, which I think is clearly intended to bring to mind ideas of agenda setting. So it's seeding, setting. And in classic social choice theory, the reason agenda setting is powerful is either because there are cycling preferences at the society kind of in a Rovian way, A to B, B to C, C to A, or there's some kind of inefficient equilibrium in a prisoner's dilemma sort of way. And I couldn't quite tell which of those or some third option that you thought that agenda setting achieved. So was it that there were inconsistent cycling preferences among the white majority, or was it kind of an informational story, which is that there were weakly formed preferences or something that once information was added of one form or another, it was able to turn those weakly formed preferences or non-existent preferences into something else?
Great question. Much more the latter. So I'm sort of drawing on work that, so one thing that is sort of helpful about these questions is that there's a way in which media is a really important character in the story, but wasn't there at the beginning of this research, right? I was telling a story about, political consequences of protests. And I got pushed by reviewers to sort of say, we don't believe you that protests, you know, almost nobody observes a protest. So how could a protest be moving voting behavior? And I was sort of saying, well, you know, assume the media is covering the protest. That doesn't seem like a big assumption. And I got pushed really hard to show that. And so that became this whole other body of work in the paper, which is showing that a protest today produces a front page headline tomorrow. If it's nonviolent, you get a headline about civil rights. If there's violence, we get a headline about, you know, riots and crime. And that for the non-South part of America that is, you know, not, again, particularly sympathetic to Black interests, you know, in many ways hostile to Black interests, but not as hostile as the segregated South, they're, but also not entirely conscious or aware of what was happening in the segregated South. So there's an assumption that, you know, here's one of the interesting details about kind of the tension around nonviolent protest. Part of why violence by the state against protesters was so useful is that some of the early protests in which there were peaceful protests and those got media coverage, the response seemed to be from the non-South part of America, oh, the system is working. We've got a protest, there's a demonstration, a right to peaceably assemble, and, you know, some people get arrested, but on the whole, like the system's working. There's no need for the North or the West to kind of take this as a matter. It's not a national concern. It's only when it escalated to state repression that people said, oh, no, this is beyond the pale, right? And so it's interesting, this an American Dilemma, there is specific, you know, one of the core claims is that if America, if the non-South part of America understood how brutal Jim Crow was, they would not let it stand. And that becomes an idea that Myrtle's idea of essentially, if the Black freedom struggle could get good public relations in kind of simple terms, that would change the debate. So coming back to your question, I see activists engaging in an informational project that is trying to kind of update the opinions of people who have only a vague idea of how brutal Jim Crow is, or are actively ignoring it in their kind of indifferent racism, and that through sustained coverage of that brutality, it moves public opinion. I think there's one other detail which I'm not sure how it fits into that model, which is that we're in the middle of the Cold War, and so there's an important kind of international dimension to this, which is the United States is trying to present itself as this, kind of the beacon of freedom. And yet we see this really vicious violence against a minority. And that really hurts the image in the international world. And in particular, it's a concern for elites. And so there's one other dimension about trying to put pressure on these elite actors to take a local, you know, to turn a local issue into a national and international issue, and in doing so, force the hand of you know, the Congress and presidency.
So I want to quickly follow up on the timeline of the effects. So you got pick a very local, like the next thing to happen, right? Like the 1968 elections and the effect on elections. But when you talked about what animated you, you talked about the New York of your and my youth, which was indeed a very much more violent than today type of place, and has you're talking about a longer run set of effects if they're driven that way. So I want to know a little bit about what you think about the, as you kind of move from a piece like this to a book, how you're thinking about the longer run effects, if they exist at all. Because, I mean, obviously, a lot of other things happen, right? There is this vast increase in crime. There's a lot of things that happen in the interim. The economy changes, you have an oil crisis, like all sorts of stuff. And how you're thinking about the effects when you go beyond the next election, which, of course, is what many activists groups are attempting to do, right? Like most people engaged in kind of long run political activism aren't thinking that they're going to win the next election or that their ideas will govern. They are, but you've defined them as minoritarian. So they're attempting to have some effect out in the distance, maybe also local, but sometimes out in the distance. So how do you think about long run effects?
Yeah, so I don't, and you're exactly right. The paper doesn't show a transition from a kind of local effect to a kind of durable governing coalition around law and order. And that's something I am thinking about how to get to in the book. But the sort of short answer I would give is that there's a moment where the and then coming back to the earlier question about thinking about this historically, I'm reading Nixon Land now by Rick Perlstein, and the opening,
such a good book.
I don't know, I've lost track of which chapter it is, but the opening, you know, 6, 7, 8 chapters are all about this transition from great society in a sense of enormous optimism about what a massive democratic governing coalition can do on behalf of equality and the environment and racial justice, to that kind of collapsing, right? And it collapses in part, you know, the Vietnam War is a central factor, but the violent unrest in cities around America, these kind of uprisings and rebellions against the status quo, just kind of break that coalition. But I think key is that, you know, in this history of kind of Nixon and the kind of surrounding characters is something that's really important, which is that the Republicans are at a loss to figure out, they don't quite know what their animating ideas are for a while. Goldwater has just lost in 64 in a blowout. Law and Order did not carry the day under Goldwater. And so there's this kind of moment of searching. And in 1966, Ronald Reagan runs for governor of California on Law and Order following the Watts uprising in 1965, and he wins. And Reagan had been thought of as a pretty fringe character up until that point. And he beats the incumbent Pat Brown, father of former California Governor Jerry Brown, you know, by a million votes. I mean, it's a crushing victory. And Nixon says, oh, right, like here, you know, it's literally kind of... Law and Order is not something that Nixon is particularly attracted to until he starts to see it as a winning issue. And then he begins to take it on as his own, runs in 68. And the kind of argument I would make is that what we see in 64, Law and Order not a winning issue in the absence of, kind of it being salient in the media, coming back to your point about the informational dimension, is potentially a counterfactual scenario. If America had remained relatively, kind of there hadn't been as much of the aggressive resistance to white supremacy, there might not have been the aggressive counter-mobilization. And that path might have meant that Humphrey wins, that the lesson, you know, maybe Reagan doesn't win. There's a set of lessons that the right takes, which are Law and Order is a losing issue, right? And but that's not what happens. And we end up with 50 years of war on drugs being started under Nixon. And I think the last thing I would say is that there's a sort of horrible feedback loop that gets that started, right? Where things like the war on drugs, like alcohol prohibition, have a crime promoting effect, right? So that you actually create vast black markets that then increases the opportunities for, organized crime to get involved and for there to be contestation over things like drug markets. And that actually I don't think Nixon intends it as a crime promoting policy. I don't think Reagan intends ratcheting up the war on drugs as a crime promoting policy. But weirdly, we end up in an equilibrium where there's more repression that creates even larger underground economies in which violence is the means in which a lot of those disputes are resolved, which produces more of the taste for more repression. And so that's part of the feedback loop that I don't get into, but is my read of how things play out.
So Omar, ordinarily probe the scholarship and sign off, but this is not an ordinary piece. You've testified, I believe, to the difficulty of kind of convincing people in your field about, the importance of this kind of work until it was obvious how important it was. But then the broader reception of the scholarship was kind of astonishing. And, I would say a little weird too. And what I have in mind there is that, you're a black man and you have a couple of white men in particular who glom onto your results, very different guys who, take it in very different directions. Of course, I have in mind David Shore and Nathan Robinson, which caused major cultural events, which will be written about, I think. And remind our listeners or tell them if they were out to lunch for that, those couple of weeks, David Shore is a kind of consumer of social science who reports your finding and gets fired. And Nathan Robinson is a kind of Bernie bro type. I'm sympathetic to his politics, who, you know, charges you basically, I would say, with honoring the haters in the framing of your project. And, you know, he, you know, a kind of a fracas of some kind ensues. You can talk about any of that. But what I basically want to ask you is, what reflections do you have on this last summer as the kind of, you know, person who's made the object, and whose kind of social science paper is made the object of this kind of cultural event with kind of really interesting characters and, you know, an unpredictable kind of outcome, given that November was still a while away at that point?
Yeah, it has been a roller coaster, and you know, you sort of, and the other detail that's probably worth mentioning is that, like, I worked on this for about 15 years. It got rejected multiple times. Like, when I got hired, I mean, I'm very lucky to be at Princeton right now. But when I got hired, one of the senior faculty said, you know, what do riots in the 1960s have what does that tell us about politics today, right? There was a kind of skepticism about what is this relevant anymore? And so, you know, that's not a question I'll get anymore, but I was kind of at the periphery of American political science. So it's been a long slog. And so to go from kind of one extreme of being really at the margins to, as you're sort of noting, being kind of part of a national conversation was head spinning. And then to kind of tick through a little bit of the cases that you highlight, and then I'll try to sum up. So with David Shore, you know, I feel like he really got a raw deal, to put it frankly. And I can't speak to the employment context, but he basically shared my work in a moment when it was either the night the police station went up in flames in Minneapolis, or, you know, the day after, the day before, I don't remember exactly, but it's a moment where the country is, you know, very focused on Minneapolis. And I think part of what the buzzsaw he walked into is that there's a kind of, part of what is both powerful, but also I think challenging about contentious politics is they can be both mobilizing and polarizing. There's a very strong sense of which side are you on? And when he presented my somewhat complicated, on the one hand, on the other hand, research, people, that kind of gray was not welcome. He was accused baselessly of racism. I think he was by people on Twitter treated badly. And then you know, there were these downstream effects. I'm encouraged to hear that he's doing okay now, but I think he was baselessly wronged, and that you know, full stop. And I didn't, you know, it was all moving so quickly, I didn't even fully, wasn't able to make sense of it for weeks. So that's one. And then Nathan Robinson sort of came at me, yeah, and exactly as you're saying. I mean, he accused me of engaging in a kind of project that was akin to, you know, like the bell curve, right? That this is a kind of essentially a racist undertaking. And what's rich about that is that it's not clear he had read the paper, right? So he, in his critique, he goes after me, but never actually cites, he doesn't quote my text, he doesn't engage with the evidence, he even says, the results might be true, but, right? And so the thing that I've sort of made sense of over time about that kind of reaction is, this also happened from some African-American critics, there's an attempt to say, well, the framing is inappropriate. And what I now understand that to mean, and, you know, I may, you know, make more sense of this over time, is that there's people feel like asking the question about whether violent tactics employed by African Americans help to hurt their cause is essentially kind of should be off the table. And that there's a kind of an effort to say, we don't care what, you know, it's whatever the opposite of consequentialist is, it's immoral to consider this question. And it's taken me a while to really grasp that and sort of make sense of what's going on there. And in defense of that argument, there's this incredibly long history of racist social science that pathologizes Black people and treats them as prone to crime. And if you look at a book like Khalil Gibran Muhammad's book, Condemnation of Blackness, it shows how deeply the emergence of social science, the emergence of statistics is embedded in narratives of demonizing Black people through crime stories. So that's some of the history that they're mobilizing or drawing on when they're sort of saying you're engaged in a racist project. But I think what that misses is the degree to which there's, like, to my mind, a kind of soft bigotry of not treating someone like Stokely Carmichael as an agent of his own, you know, success or failure. And that it actually is sort of saying, well, just because somebody advocates for a violent tactic, or just because somebody makes a moral claim for the legitimacy of violence, we are not going to actually treat that as a meaningful claim. Like, we're going to write that. We're not going to allow you to engage with that, right? So let me try to make this a little more precise. There's in Frederick Douglass's What to the Slave is the 4th of July, he's got this very nice passage where he engages with the question of, like, what is it to be human? And he says, to be human is to be moral, is to be intellectual, and is to be responsible, right? And that part of what I am trying to do is to say, I think of Angela Davis as moral, intellectual, and responsible. And in doing that, I need to sort of say, well, like, she proposes the theory of change. How does that hold up? Right. And what my critics are saying, Nathan Robinson and some others, is saying, we don't want to, moral and intellectual are okay, but responsible is not. And I think that fundamentally dehumanizes people in a way that I reject. Right. So that's part of my response. And then the last thing I would say is there's a kind of Black exceptionalism, which I, you know, I can understand, but it's like, there are, you know, there's a great paper on anti-austerity movements in Barcelona and Spain that escalate to violence. And nobody's up in arms about the immorality of asking, is that violence beyond the scope of empirical research? Erica Chenoweth and Maria Steven have this great book that looks at 300 different movements, some of which use violence, some of which don't. There's no sense of looking at the consequences of violent tactics is somehow, beyond the pale. And so into that kind of Black exceptionalism is, for me, a story which has its roots in all of the media bias, all of the kind of long history of pathologizing Black people, of, we don't want stories that are, don't air our dirty laundry in public. Don't tell stories that are negative in public. I understand that approach, but to me, it's a fundamentally kind of immature approach. And so I reject it. And I think really to take someone like Angela Davis or Ella Baker seriously is to evaluate their ideas and see how they play out.
Well, that was terrific. Thank you so much for coming on. This was a wonderful podcast. It was really a lot of fun. I learned a ton. This was great. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Omar.
Thank you for having me. Really grateful for the opportunity.